chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. Oh yes, oh, I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas to hello, everyone. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the new American Dream Radio Show. And we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, also on revolution.radio. And it's a listener-supported network. They really deserve your support. Been a lot of things going on lately with the death of our beloved Nighthawk, among others. And, hey, it's Christmas time. Show them some generosity. Head on over there, revolution.radio or freedomslips.com, and show them some love. Look for that donation button, and you use it. Alrighty then. I'm pleased to welcome you all here to the show tonight. And we're going to be starting off with my friend Anthony Rayson in Chicago. Anthony is a prison activist. He creates zines that are sent out to prisoners, and many of them include prisoner writings, which he gets from the letters that people send him. It's just an amazing project, and he's been doing it for many, many years. And I'm going to add Anthony into the show right about now. It's really an honor to have Anthony Rayson on our show.
So hello.
Hello, Anthony. Merry Christmas and welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You are on the air.
Well, thank you. What I want to talk about tonight is marijuana. January 1st, Illinois is going to be legal for recreational marijuana use. So that's a big change in this state, and it's sort of sweeping the country. But as usual, the wrong people are the ones benefiting from this and making money from it. And all too often, they're the same that were not too long ago being the big oppressors and the ones arresting us and imprisoning us for these alleged crimes of possession or use of marijuana. Well, it's pretty well understood now that it's a medicinal plant. It's an incredible, useful drug to help any number of conditions, illnesses, diseases. Has all kinds of applications as far as food and energy and clothing and you name it. It's probably better than what's being used now for whatever the application would be. Yesterday there was a bit of a to-do in Chicago. The black aldermen were trying to delay the trotting out of the legalization till July so they could get some black ownership of the dispensaries. Well, you know, even though we have a new black mayor, she wasn't going to put up with that because the city wants to start making money fast, and they will hand over fist with the high taxes. And they also want to run their own city-run dispensaries down the road as well as a huge casino. So they're looking to, you know, make money off all this after being the government that has destroyed tens of millions of lives through these decades of prohibition. So it really irks me that it's sort of, you know, like just swept under the rug, like nothing happened, like there's no accountability, all this horrible things that were done to all these people for no reason all these years, nothing's going to really come of it. All this talk of expunging a few records, you know, of marijuana, only convicted felons, if that's going to really help their lives any. So it's the same old story. We've been lied to by the government, and we've been oppressed by the government using these lies to illegalize normal behavior. Human behavior has been using hemp for thousands of years for the medicinal qualities that it has, and for whatever else purposes they wanted to use it for. So anyway, there was an earlier thing called the marijuana medical program, the pilot program. Illinois was started in 2018, and I got on that this spring because I was so hurting from all the surgeries I was having. I had a knee replacement and I had so much pain. I was unable to sleep, and all the drugs they gave me, nothing worked. So the only thing that really helped me sleep at night was cannabis. So it's kind of interesting. I got a menu here from Windy City Cannabis. This is what they show you, what you can get when you go in there. Now, cannabis is broken down into sativa and indica, two main kinds of sativa, more psychoactive, and indica, sort of more sleep-inducing. So they got a laundry list of all these wild name things, and the THC percentages, the CBD percentages, and how much it is, and blah, blah. And there's pre-rolled cigarettes, and there's high CBD content. There's dominant hybrids and indica hybrids. There's stuff called shake. I don't even know what it is. Popcorn, whatever that is. And there's chocolates and baked goods and candies and drinks and wax, whatever that is. Live resin, shatter, whatever that is. It's a huge THC kind of 85-90%. Hash, which is, I get some hash. It's pretty cool. You can get hash legally from, you know, this dispensary. Creams, balms, capsules, suppositories, transdermal patches, sprays, tinctures, resin cartridges, vape oil cartridges of all kinds and flavors. So it's an insane amount of products they have just for as cannabis as a medical product. And of course there's all other these other applications. Anyway, I have a piece I wrote a few years ago about this subject. You may recall when Michael Phelps smoked that bong with these college kids out in North Carolina. It was sort of the MySpace bong hit around the world. So I started from there, and it's titled For Whom the Bong Roils. I heard on the radio on my way to work today that some cracker piggy down in South Carolina was squealing about how he's going to try and bust a Jughead-looking Michael Phelps for that MySpace bong hit being shown around the world. Unlike the liar Bill Clinton, he looked intent on inhaling. The sports guys condemned him for being stupid. I have to listen to these guys because there's no real politics stations except the dishwater liberals and the out-and-out Nazis. What's stupid is the pandemic ignorance given as understood common sense by society's mouthpieces on this and all other incidents, subjects, motives, justifications, and every which way of looking at, analyzing, and understanding and responding to any situation. That cracker piggy is the last line of defense for a sick system of lockdown laws and lickspittle conformity to real-time vicious human enslavement and crippling ideas-wide, meticulously inculcated vast ignorance. Plants and animals have a fundamental symbiotic relationship, so much so that our mutual survival depends on it. Marijuana, Cannabis sativa, is a very complex plant chemically, perhaps the most complex in the plant kingdom. It is the human being of the plant kingdom, without the horrific downside humans display, evil and its tolerance. Perhaps the only things marijuana is capable of destroying are illusions, which accounts for why this benign, medicinal, and incredibly applicable and useful psychoactive plant has been so criminalized and lied about by the trigger-happy, tasering government and the police dog-trained cops. Its big threat to the system is the very nature of its existence. Here's a plant that grows wild everywhere, whether cultivated or not, that has the ability to be used for practically any conceivable application. It's also a lot of fun to smoke or otherwise ingest for purely pleasurable purposes with practically zero side effects, but can also be used for a vast array of highly useful purposes, from rope, sails, clothing, many types of oils as a food source, and many medicinal purposes. Cancer patients, AIDS patients, and others suffering various ailments and debilitating conditions, such as chemo patients, I found that no other natural or developed medicine provides anywhere near the necessary relief that pot does with next to zero side effects. It's true. The cannabis plant is far superior to any other medicine concocted by pharmaceutical companies using any other plants or chemical compounds. That's incredibly amazing, especially when you consider how hard the government has worked to prevent the study and development of the no doubt huge number of valuable applications it could and should be adapted for. People suffer and die painful deaths because the government refuses to allow them to use it and refuses to allow scientists to discover better uses for it. Yet hundreds of thousands are forced into this monstrous cage life known as prison because of the reaction by government to marijuana, not because of this brilliant plant, but because of government's insane and cruel reaction to it. Why is the reaction to marijuana so severe and life-ruining for so many? It's because, like I mentioned earlier, by its very existence, it blows out of the water all the lies this putrid society is fundamentally based upon. All the other drugs foisted upon the population, Ritalin, Darban, Thorazine, alcohol, nicotine, et infinitum, do the users more harm than good and force that person's psyche to cope with having these harmful drugs in their system. They are forced to maintain, come down, and no doubt repeat this vicious cycle a short time later. These episodes of drug taking, whether legal or under the doctor's care, are just ingested by a curious experimenter, have the effect of altering that person's chemistry and kicking in the body's coping mechanisms to deal with it. Does this sound like a conducive situation for a person to experience such things as genuine understanding, insight, perspective, clarity, or any kind of mental growth and empowerment? Of course not. It leaves a person at a bare minimum of comprehension. Often only the appropriately nicknamed idiot box is vaguely absorbed, and most people are left in a perpetual state of base ignorance that the trained liars, hyenas, and apologists for the social ugliness known as democracy keep entertained and subdued with their medicines. So most Americans don't know much of anything that the government doesn't want them to know, namely the details and horrific truth of what the government actually does. Their fragile eggshell minds aren't in a position to learn and deal with this truth. For the most part, they don't know where Iraq is on a map, but they do know who Scooby-Doo is. It's beyond shameful that this is the only way this vile government can maintain its grip, through the deliberate stupidification of its people. This is basically why marijuana is so detested by the authorities. It is insidious, cheap, and readily available. Approximately 13-14% of people use it, and this is true along every demographic, every ethnic and social group, among cops, politicians, everybody. It's so easy to use, fun, and harmless. Right there, the lie is shown to everybody. This stuff isn't harmful at all. The only harm is when the uniformed and heavily armed kidnapping goons get their disgusting paws on you and force you through their vile for-profit justice nightmare. Again, taking a hit off a joint, quite harmless, but getting tasered or hit with a bully club is very harmful. Smiling, harmless. Getting shot, harmful. So what's harmful? Is it marijuana or the goddamn government? Half the people have tried it, and none of them have keeled over because of it. But if you refuse to stay in the psychological cage, they will put you in a physical one. People learn the lesson that the government is a total liar when they wage their insane campaign of lies and kidnapping, arresting, and etc. People feel government lies about everything, and basically they do. But people don't know how to cope with the realization that most everything they've been taught and made to do has been wrong in an endless series of lie-based manipulations. This, thus, is Pandora's box being opened, where it leads to confusion, possible incarceration, accommodation, assimilation, more addictive substances of the path of actualization, realization, and ongoing adaptation to find ways to put into social practice insight and a real education and what it can accomplish. Self-respect-driven humanist action is up to each individual, tempered by the very real possible intrusion by the state. The truth is that pot is benign, yet insanely targeted selectively, and thus it is a huge social problem. The problem is that the insane government has criminalized all these people for no good reason, sort of like how they murdered a million Iraqis based on some non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, many move on to harder drugs like cigarettes, alcohol, TV, cocaine, heroin, prescriptions, violence, capitalist exploitation, and so forth. Before smoking marijuana, these people were on junk food, TV, movies, the brainwashing in grade school, mother's milk, etc. How are all the poor choices people make after smoking pot marijuana's fault? All those other drugs, before and after, are much more harmful, except mother's milk, and way less able to help free one's mind to actually think out of the rat race thoughts. Of course, many new mothers don't provide their babies with breast milk, but rather crappy powdered milk and sweetened drinks. The good marijuana could possibly do as recreation, as medicine, or useful products, or as whatever, is constantly being ignored, illegalized, purposely refused to allow to be scientifically developed, lied about, demonized, and criminalized. So all the other drugs are bad, and the only good drug isn't allowed to be good. Everybody loses. The only winners are the pharmaceutical companies pushing drugs and the government for-profit punishment industry. Years ago, back in the 60s, all kinds of new people were getting hip to smoking weed, something that people have been doing for thousands of years, as it is merely the dried leaves and flowers of a widespread plant. Many other such psychoactive plants throughout the history of the world were also used then and now extensively. Marijuana may well be the most useful and least harmful of any of them. The only thing close to it would be caffeine, and that's back with the pack, too, in my opinion. And most despised of all, pot's the one carrying the black flag of anarchy. The danger comes with the extent of the realization that we are faced with lunatics and monsters of a singularly rabid variety. Remember, lies are the truth, love is war, greed is good. If you don't believe our fascist lies, we'll kill you. In Vietnam, soldiers were blowing each other stingers out of their M16s instead of blowing people's brains out. They came to realize what Muhammad Ali had said was all true for them. Also true for them, namely, I got nothing against no Viet Cong. This expressed their sentiments in a very immediate way. For to follow the orders of their officers was highly dangerous to body and mind. Getting high instead of forcing themselves in dangerous nightmare firefights made them think, why should we go out on patrol and get our asses shot? Let's just frag the friggin' lieutenant. When your soldiers realize who their real tormentors are, a la the Russian soldiers in 1917, then it's Katie bar the door. This is what ultimately ended that horrible bloodbath, the insurrection and mutiny of the U.S. soldiers themselves. The policymakers of mass death blamed this loss on the effect marijuana had on these soldiers. They came to realize that their own lives and those of the Vietnamese they were ordered to murder were more important than the career advancements of their officers and the political viability of the criminals in Washington. Smoking pot had made these killing machines turn back into human beings. This evil government, who had murdered 3 million souls in Southeast Asia, had to leave with the tails between their legs, punching their way to their seat on the evacuation helicopter atop the U.S. Embassy. They blamed pot for letting the cat out of the bag and turning scared and obedient soldiers into anti-war heroes. Look, just like the hot summers in the mid-60s in the urban ghettos, when young Africans basically revolted like the oppressed people they are, only to be brutally shot, the government has declared war on a whole group of people. Young Africans, males in particular, have been criminalized for this affront and been incarcerated en masse ever since. So too are marijuana users paying a monstrous price to this day for our insubordination, smoking pot and reminding everybody in the world that the U.S. was and is under brutal occupation. The cry of freedom and make love, not war, results in the brutal incarceration of hundreds of thousands of young Africans, basically for being dark-skinned and poor, and hundreds of thousands of vicious pot smokers. So young Africans and pot smokers are targeted for persecution, not for doing anything harmful, but what they represent, refusal to live their lives under the boot heel of government. This criminalization serves multiple purposes as an all-around excuse to crack down on any and all activity, especially those outside the box. Alternate lifestyles, co-ops, politically organized opposition, any kind of group can be said to be in a gang, and thus up to criminal behavior such as drug dealing. The whole sections of society are basically cordoned off like a homegrown Gaza and made to suffer while everybody is doing the same thing too. Michael Phelps smoked a bong. He was contrite, lost his Kellogg's endorsement deal, and was suspended from swimming for 3 months. 9 people were busted by the cracker cop in South Carolina, supposedly involved in this somehow. Every day, thousands of people go to court over minor pot possession charges and other charges tacked on. There are a million laws to choose a criminal violation from. The prisons are bursting at the seams with brutalized prisoners. The economy is in the toilet thanks to the real criminals being hard at work and the corporate vipers and the mass murders of government. It looks like the only thing to do in these desperate times is to overcome our ignorance and fear and realize who our real enemies are. Is it a medicinal plant or this vile system of exploitation? Now, can we flick off the idiot box and determine what is to be done? So, yeah, it riles you up, you know, thinking about it. It's just not right. So, yeah, things are finally starting to change a little bit, but it's super expensive. I mean, people that need it can't afford it. You have to pay cash when you go get this stuff, and it's very difficult to get a doctor to vouch for you to get on this. You know, a lot of the doctor, like my surgeons, they refuse to have anything to do with this because they're hooked up with the Franciscan network. But yeah, the one doctor was prescribing me so many of these pain pills, these codeine pills, it was just destroying my guts. You know, well, had to do something.
He was probably getting a great kickback from some pharmaceutical company.
Well, that could be true, too. But
Anthony, that was an incredible piece. We are out of time, but
okay.
Wow. I mean, that was just fantastic. Thank you so much for reading that. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Yeah, well, we got to take a stand, and then, you know, people fighting this, and then finally starting to pay off, really, you know?
Exactly, yes.
It's been a real war and a lot of victims, but...
You bet.
It's,
all right.
It's a real victory.
Thanks
all right,
again.
Man.
I really appreciate having you on the show, and I'll talk to you next year.
All right. Sounds great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Welcome back, everyone. And now it's time to... pull into the show, Philip Ferrugio. Philip joins me each week from Port Orange, Florida. He always has some very interesting things to say, And as usual, we start off with his column, It's the Empire, Stupid. And so we're calling him right now, and he's going to read the column, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. So here we go with Philip Ferrugio from Port Orange, Florida. Well, hello, Philip. It's the Empire, Stupid. Let's hear that column.
You know, it's there's a Democratic debate going on right now, but I had to tape it. Be with Chuck Gregory. The three evils, Chuck, being that we're having this impeachment and the Democratic debate and all the other stuff. The late Martin Luther King Jr., you know, he gave a stirring speech on August 31st, 1967, and it sadly rings true today. In his comprehensive look at what ails not only America, but most of the Western world, King focused on this salient point, quote, "But I suggest that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness that has been lurking within our body politic from its beginning. That is the sickness of the evils of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism," unquote. Well, 50 years later, it's worse now than ever. Why is it that so many low- and middle-income white people continue to follow Trump like the Pied Piper? Yes, one of the leading polled reasons they give is the need for more jobs here at home and not offshore. Trump sold them on that, even though most of the jobs he helped deliver are simply dead end ones. Another polled reason is the disdain by many for big government and the entitlements, a.k.a. welfare, given out to many at the expense of those who cherish the work ethic. Translated, that means stop giving free rides to the blacks and browns. Other polling reveals how those who support Trump and his party are fearful of terrorism. You know, the old PR move by the Bush-Cheney gang to, quote, fight them there so they don't come here, unquote. Thus, the more money spent on a strong military, the better, even if it means these low- and middle-income white Trump supporters will have even less of a safety net. Well, they figure, what I can't get in the way of government aid that the blacks and browns won't get either. Such is how this covert racism shows its ugly head. Of course, for generations, many white Americans continue to vote for Republicans because the Republicans will do their best to really, honestly keep the browns and blacks away from my neighborhood. Plain and simple. Remember, the worst and most threatening situation facing Dr. King was when he led a march for fair housing in Chicago. He could not believe how violent the white working stiff mob there could be. Now, on the subject of excessive materialism, just channel surf a bit and see how consumed we are as a culture for things. Junior Bush, he said it best after 9/11 by telling Americans to shop. The real sin is how so many people I know have bought into this whole celebration of the super rich and the dream of investment wealth. So many middle-income folks want to become absentee landlords, earning money off of other people's need for a place to live. And on the subject of self-centeredness, go to any public place, like my local health club, and see the abundance of electronic gadgets and people walking around with wires coming out of their ears. During my baby boomer youth and middle age, people used to actually speak to one another at the gym. With these gadgets, no one even speaks to others via their phones anymore. They text. As a man who makes his living via the telephone, speaking to small businesses nationwide, the verbal skills of America's youth are not so great and getting worse. As far as enriching oneself intellectually, librarians tell me that more movie DVDs are borrowed than books by a wide margin. Remember the Peter Sellers characters in the movie Being There? He was a mentally challenged man. When he asked what he likes, he answered, "I like to watch." Dr. King knew that by 1967, extreme militarism was running rampant. Then finally, he began to see the upsurge of dissent to this insanity finally growing each and every day. This was especially aided by the evening news covering daily the death and destruction of and by our military in Vietnam. A few months previous to his August 31st speech, King gave a historically stirring one at the Riverside Church. The most famous line from this October 4th speech, 1967, was when he called our country the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. He then was able to do something which today's Democrat and, of course, Republican political leaders and embedded media refuse to do, that being to connect the massive funding for militarism against the needs for more money for our safety net and other vital considerations. Sounds familiar? Right. Wouldn't it be natural for most working stiff Americans to understand how increased spending on militarism at the expense of their needs was not economically healthy? Well, in 1967, the real deep state, with help from that same embedded mainstream media, played the Cold War commie threat card so effectively. We know that after 9/11, the real deep state continues to play the terrorist fear card so well. Talk about a Me Too movement. We have both political parties using it continuously, always parroted by the good old prostitute media. Thomas Jefferson said it best. He said, "All tyranny needs to gain a foothold is for people of good conscience to do nothing." Thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Very powerful, Phil. You know, one...
Is that me or the piece?
Both. Merry Christmas.
Humbug.
Hey, now, you know, one factor you didn't mention that I'm pretty sure is in there is that, you talked about how they use the economy, they funnel everything into the war, into the military. And, one reason, one of the tools they use to sell that is that, hey, here's a way out for you guys that can't get any regular jobs. You can join the military and... Yeah. We're gonna give you all kinds of educational benefits, and you're gonna make lots of money, and you even get to go overseas and kill people. Hey, what could be better than that?
Right. That's right. No, it's true. I mean, Michael Moore, he captured that in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11, when he showed the recruiters going into the poor neighborhoods. At the shopping malls and other places, and really, hitting on these young, mostly Afro-American kids to join up, And it's sad, but you're right. I mean, they offer these kids all kinds of, bonuses to sign up, And then a year later, the kid finds out he's going overseas to the Middle East. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing there.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, they're feeding him amphetamines, to keep them awake and keep them on edge. It's really a, Chuck, it's really a, this militarism has become, it is a sickness. It really is.
It is.
It's a sickness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because as much as the right wing and the Bush-Cheney gang and Trump and how they push this, this thing about, really trying to get back at the Browns and blacks, that's what they're really doing, with all their little schemes they have going. But it's funny because if you go in the military, it's filled with black and white together, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's funny how they don't mind discriminating outside of the military, but when it comes to the military, they like to get those black and brown, faces,
Exactly. And somehow, all the people, mostly get along, and it's which, they push the division, the racism, in civilian life, but Yeah, yeah. In the military, it's all about, well, we're the warriors and you're not.
Yeah, it carries over into the police too, because.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, growing up in the '60s, honestly, you know, we respected the police. You know, we did. You know, and there was a cop on the beat. There was actually a cop on the. I mean, I remember the cop. One cop. Sometimes there were two together. Cops on the beat. You know, carrying the nightstick. You know, swinging the nightstick. And you know, I mean, yes. You know, and you know, a lot of neighborhoods, you know, knew the cop, the beat, whether it be a black neighborhood or white neighborhood, didn't matter, a mixed neighborhood.
Yeah.
But then they put them in cars only, right?
Mm-hmm.
They put them in cars only. They took away the beat cops, and you didn't know anybody until the cop pulled over and got out, and it became a whole different world then.
Yeah.
You know, then they were like the U.S. Army when we occupied Afghanistan and Iraq, driving around in the Humvee, totally insulated from the people around out in the street. You know.
Right, right. They turned them into a higher class, a higher echelon, going out and basically being in charge. Instead of working with people, they were ordering people around. Instead of
that's a good point. That's
people,
a very good point. You know.
Yeah.
You know, you raise a really good point. Really, and this is probably the most important point of the of our little chat. You raise a very important point, because a police was originally was supposed to be a public servant. They were there to protect. What they say, to protect and serve.
Exactly.
So think about that: protect and serve, mm-hmm. not to order, not to be in charge, to protect and to serve.
Yeah.
So you're right. That was what they were supposed to be. And now, you know, unfortunately, you know, when you see a police car pull up, you know, you don't think of him as there to protect you or serve you.
Right.
You're thinking that
you start looking for where can you go to get away.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sad, isn't it? It really is.
It is.
And, you know, and I think what happened also is with these phony wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, with all these, you know, military guys coming home, a lot of them go into the police.
Right.
You know, I live here in Florida. Mm-hmm. You know, our local police force has a lot of these guys, ex-military, and I'm not trying to put them down. I don't want to put them in a bundle with each other. But I always felt that, Chuck, if you're going to have police in any community, the police should be college graduates. That should be the first prerequisite. You cannot become a police officer unless you have a 4-year college degree. And you should have some sort of at least have a minor in either sociology or criminal justice, you know, or maybe sociology itself. And that should be the prerequisite. And I think if that happened, I can't prove this, but I bet you a lot of these shootings that were done on unarmed people, black or white, but I bet you a lot of those police officers were not college graduates. Okay.
Well,
they were probably just maybe high school graduates.
Yeah, I'm not actually convinced that having them, you know, with a college degree would help. I think the actual training that is part of their job might actually be more important. I know that when I was working as an electronic technician back in the, I don't know, 70s, 80s, somewhere in there, one of the guys that hired me told me that, you've got a really good degree here. That's worth about 6 months of on-the-job training. And I said, wow,
okay.
Really? I thought it was a little more, but no, he said no, because when the people are here training, you know, learning the actual job instead of some pie in the sky, whatever, he was kind of negative about the whole college thing, but he actually made a good point. And while I really believe in college, and especially in liberal arts programs, where you're learning a lot of different things, different fields, rather than learning how to do a specific job that the, establishment, as we used to call it, wants you to do. There's still, once you do actually get down to that job, you need hands-on training, and you need some help with the whole mindset. If your mindset is to dominate, then that's the kind of, cop or whatever you're going to be. If your mindset is to help and protect, then you might not get into those situations.
I understand what you're saying, but here's my point. When I went to Brooklyn College, I was 18, and let's say after 4 or 5 years, I took a little longer, but the point is that every year I was there, I grew up, especially at that age. And when you see these guys come out of high school now and they go and take a course or something so they can qualify to be a police officer, but he's like 20 years old maybe when he becomes a cop. And when you graduate college, you're usually 21 or 22, so you're a little bit older. And, Chuck, I don't know, but I'm not talking about taking classes online. That's a whole different way of education, which I'm not really crazy about, to be honest with you. I think the greatest thing is when you walk into a campus or a building and you go to classes with other people, you sit, you mingle, you rub elbows, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And a college campus is such a growing experience. So when you get out of that college, whatever degree you have after 4 years, you're a much more sophisticated, not only educated, but sophisticated person than when you were 18 or 19.
Yes,
that's my point.
Because the experience on a college campus, you're not just learning in class. You're not just learning from the faculty.
Right.
You're learning from all of the other people that are in the classes with you, that walk around the same campus, go to the same parties, get into the same trouble.
The activities.
So yes, I strongly believe in the colleges in that sense.
I'm just telling you that unfortunately, in most instances, and I'm not being negative towards the police. I really am not, because it's a tough job. But a lot of the police that I run into, I can just, when I talk to these guys or women, mostly guys, but even women, but they just don't have the sophistication level that I know a college graduate would probably have, and it's like, it's hard to explain unless you experience it when you talk to a police officer.
Let's look for a second at the military and what kind of training you receive when you're in the military. Now, I don't happen to know this firsthand. I was fortunate never to be part of that. But I've got a pretty good idea of what goes on there, and I know lots of people who have been through it, some more successfully than others. And, it seems to me probably the one thing that is the most similar to the experience of, say, a boot camp and, that whole, training regimen. There's only one place that I can think of where the environment is similar. Can you guess what that is?
What, jail?
Exactly. Because because it's so regimented. You have to follow orders. You have to do exactly what you're told to do. Don't even think about arguing. And if you're unlucky and nobody in the group argues, then somebody you might get singled out just because you happen to be there.
You know, it's funny you said that. And I'm not trying to make a joke of this, but I'm thinking back 55 years ago when I was in junior high school, okay? And I remember that a whole bunch of the guys that we used to call hoods, you remember that word, hood?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was short for hoodlum.
It was short for hoodlum.
But
right?
Yeah, but all the guys, a lot of the guys in my grade, let's say I was in the eighth grade, a lot of the guys in the eighth grade that we would call the hoods, you know, the guys who were the tough guys or they used to hang out together, you know,
right.
Smoking cigarettes,
yeah.
doing things they shouldn't have done.
You were the guys beating up on people like me. Okay.
No, but let me tell you what happened. I mean, years later, when I ran into some of them and I asked them, how's so-and-so do? They either became criminals or cops.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I'm not making it up.
Because really, there's just a very fine line between those two. It's crazy.
And I'm not putting down police officers because there's a lot of really good guys and girls out, women out there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know lots of really good ones, and they're really out to help people. But
yeah, so that's the militarism in this country that I was writing about. That's the extreme militarism. It carries over into the local police, and it's really sad, Chuck. It really is.
It really is.
You know, so I don't know what the answer is. The answer is for us as people to look beyond the two-party system and to start thinking about what are the big things that need to be changed, you know?
And also, it's to talk to people and listen to people. Both of those are so important. And, you know, you may feel like you're diametrically opposed to what somebody else stands for, to who they are. But if you really sit down, if you get yourself to sit down across the table from them, drink a cup of coffee or something, and talk, you find out you have so much in common. So many things that you actually agree on. And it's just
a
question
friend.
Of how to get there.
I have a new friend for the last, like, 2-3 years now. He's a year older than me. And he's a nice guy. We're both Italian American. He comes from Rochester. I come from, you know, Brooklyn, and we're both college graduates, you know. He's very conservative, politically, but on certain issues he's not. He's a little bit more progressive than others, and we don't agree on a lot of things, you know, politically, but we agree on a lot of, you know, social commentary, We agree on some things, and we both like sports, and we like to talk about sports and other things. So we get along really well, and, you know, sometimes I don't like it when he likes to bring up politics because I tell him, you know, we don't agree on that, so I don't know if it's worth really, you know, having an argument. And so I try to, you know, steer him away from, you know, certain conversations because it's not fruitful when two people are diametrically opposed on certain issues.
If it has to be an argument, then yes, it's not fruitful.
But he's a very nice guy.
If it can become a debate, and you're each willing to listen to what the other is saying, it's amazing what you can accomplish toward finding a middle ground.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation. I think you're probably going to get rid of me real quick, right? So let me wish everybody listening a very happy Christmas next week, you know, and things are rough now, you know. I feel very frustrated at what's happening around me all over. And all I can say is you got to try to find the faith, you know, within you, because Love is God. How's that?
Yes. Love is God, and God is love, and you got to never give up.
You got Philip, my friend. That's a good way to end this.
Thank you so much. This really has been a good conversation. I enjoyed it very much. I hope our listeners
did,
too.
Okay, we'll talk again.
You betcha. All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yep. Bye-bye. Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. Our next guest of the evening is Larry Pinkney. Larry joins us each month from Minneapolis. Larry's an original Black Panther, and he always has some very interesting things to say for us. So we're going to add him to the show right now. And here we go. We're trying to get him on now. I'm certainly glad.
Good evening. Larry Pinkney speaking.
Well, hello, Larry. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Well, did I interrupt the conversation or something?
No, that's okay. Go for it. How are you?
I'm okay. I think that what's going through my mind right now is how absurd, ludicrous, outrageous, and disgusting what's going on in Washington D.C. in our federal government is taking place. This is just outrageous. And,
okay.
But personally, I'm okay. Okay. I mean, you know, Christmas is coming up in just a few days from now. And I've never in my life seen a time where we couldn't put aside, we, the American people, couldn't put aside our differences to get together with family and friends or for just by ourselves or whatever. But to put aside that and, you know, whatever those differences were, to enjoy one another's company, to appreciate one another. All right. And this is, to me, frankly, beyond belief. The hatred, the vitriolity, the hubris of it all is the hyperbole of it all. Excuse me. Is just beyond belief. And I'm not young. You know, I know that song that Tower of Power sings called You're Still a Young Man, but I'm not a young man. And this is beyond belief. All for, you know, showcasing and standing up. What about our republic? What about our country? What about our nation? You know, it's like, to me, I am very, very concerned about the future, about the republic, about really the nation as a whole. We can have our differences. In fact, we should have differences. But when we start making personal attacks, you voted for so-and-so, and that means, you know, you're a degenerate, or you're a deplorable, or you're a super predator, or you're, well, wait a minute, that's way overboard, okay? Fair game, if a person is a candidate, then you should be looked at. You should be called to make an accounting. But we the people, everyday ordinary people, this is just beyond belief. I'm old enough to remember John Fitzgerald Kennedy. All right.
Yes.
I liked him. I wasn't quite old enough to have voted for him. I wasn't a voting age, but I remembered him. I was a teenager. All right. And I admired him. Okay. From what I knew. All right. And the deeper I dig, the deeper I realize that this man was assassinated by what's generally referred to as the deep state. I don't care whether it was a D behind his name or an R behind his name.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And enough, you know, enough is enough is enough. And, you know, whether people like the president or not, that's not what our politics or our political system should be based upon. We have three branches of government. Okay. I assume everyone knows that. You know, the legislative, the judicial, the executive. Well,
yeah.
Apparently not. Apparently it's because if I don't like someone, well, we have to get him out. What? What? I can't even believe it, Chuck. It's like, what has happened to our common sense? What has happened to our ability to be independent thinkers? Okay? Again, it's not about whether one likes President Trump or not.
Right.
It's about, wait a minute, pull back here. Let's understand what this means for all of us.
Okay.
I've never seen in my entire life the nation so divided. But go ahead, Bill.
Agreed. Let me ask you something, Larry. You know, this is the third time a president has been impeached. The fourth time a vote was held, but the third time, you know, because Nixon resigned. In the 90s, I'm not convinced that there were any more grounds that it was any less partisan than this time around. What do you think?
Well, my first response to you is, what is your point? I'm not either. I agree with that.
Okay.
Okay. But what is your point? Okay.
Well,
My point,
Larry, is that this started a long time ago. The partisanship, if you're not my party's candidate, I'm going to do everything I can to take you down instead of, darn, you're not my party's candidate, and I really wanted my person to win, but maybe we can work together for the good of the country.
But I never saw that. Bill Clinton had what's called, you're talking about, or at least I'm talking about, what was generally called in political terms a honeymoon period. He did get that. He had a honeymoon period.
He did
virtually
have that for a while, and Trump certainly didn't. You're right there.
He never did. President Trump never had a honeymoon period.
Yeah.
He never had a period where people said what you just said. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's also disgusting. You know, whether I agree or again, this is not about President Trump. This is about our future, our system, and how we're destroying it and destroying each other. You know, partisan politics is something that has been in this country since its very inception. But even when we have partisan politics, and I'm going to go back to the point I made before, Chuck, you know, there was always a 3 to 6 month period where whomever was elected was given a so-called honeymoon period. Why, this man has never had a honeymoon period politically or otherwise. In fact, not since he got in, even before he was inaugurated. This is insane. And again, I'm not talking about President Trump so much as I'm talking about the system. What are we doing and why are we doing this? Have we lost our minds? But anyway. As you can tell, I'm a little bit dispassionate.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it sure seems like we have lost our minds as a country. We're supposed to be about talking to each other and finding common ground and doing things for the good of everybody. And
exactly.
So many people have just totally lost sight of that. It's frightening It's disgusting. It's
yes,
sad.
It is. and it needs to be. We need to do a full reverse on this. A full stop, as the British would say. I go further and say a full reverse. Mm-hmm. We don't have to agree. As a matter of fact,
exactly.
I would prefer that we don't. But to go to the next level of attacking, it's like, wait a minute, sit down, reason with one another. One can still walk away from the table in disagreement, but at least as Americans, as citizens of this country, we should be able to have enough common sense, which is apparently not so common these days, to be able to at least say, wait a minute, I don't agree with that, but he or she has a good point. Maybe I should think about it. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's why I say this is insane. We need to put a full stop to this insanity. Turn it around. This is not about President Trump. This is about our political system, our entire future of our republic. And or I should say it's not only about President Trump. It's really about our republic. It's about our system. It's about how we look at ourselves, how we view ourselves. It's about our so-called ideals. And, you know, I find this, you know, and I'm speaking as a veteran of the Black Panther Party. And no one can say to me that we did not stand up and pay serious prices, consequences for what we did. However, this is, in the words of the late, great Curtis Mayfield, this is my country. Okay? Mm. And as such, it is important for me, all of us, to be able to recognize the value in being able to disagree with civility and move forward with civility. That's okay. In fact, that's what this system should be all about. I have never, Chuck, I'm saying to you again, brother, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Indeed.
Never. And I'm not a young man. So,
yeah.
You know, but I have hope. I've got hope, actualized hope. It's time to stop being insane. And I say that to everybody. Time to stop being insane. Pull back, reverse, full stop, and get a grip on things. This partisanship has gone too far, too fast, and it's too weird. This is amazing. So, so much for Larry Pinkney's words this evening.
Well, Larry, thank you. It's a voice of reason, and I appreciate that. You know, I really appreciate having you on the show each month. This one just as much as the others, and it's always good to hear your point of view, and like I say, a voice of reason.
Sometimes a voice from the wilderness, but you know.
Well, I'm pretty sure we're all in the wilderness, but.
But look, Chuck, thank you so much. Thank you to the listening audience, and let's move on. Let's try to strike a tone of civility and honesty. Let's be genuine as much as we can, and move forward. And as we used to say back in the day, all power to the people, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, all power to the people.
I love that saying. Thank you very much. And I look forward
Thank
to
you.
Talking to you again next year.
Okay, Joe.
Okay, right.
Take care, and we'll talk next year. Have a wonderful Christmas and a very happy, not only happy, but a productive and safe New Year, my brother.
And the same thing right back at you.
I love it. Thank you, Chuck. Talk to you
Thank
later.
You, Larry.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that was a very good segment from Larry Pinkney. And now it's time to introduce the conversation I had earlier this evening with Frank Cordero. Frank runs the Des Moines, Iowa Catholic Worker House, and he's a weekly columnist, and we had a very interesting conversation earlier, and I'm going to play that for you right now.
Chuck.
Hello, Frank. How are you?
I'm fine. I was thinking you might call me. Why not? It's close to 5, and I'm just now getting in my van, but I was prepared for you to come. So okay. I brought my notes, thinking that maybe I'll just do it in the car if you call me. I was on my way to the mailbox.
Okay.
Right now during, it's like a week or like, you know, it's been about 3 weeks since we put out our November VP, and it was our fundraising. It's the last
yes.
issue of the year.
Yes.
And,
very nice issue.
And then I got to get there every day to get the checks. This is when build up our bank account and try to make it through the year. So I got to go to the mailbox every day because it gets full, you know. It's amazing.
Well,
we're really grateful.
What? Hey, that's a very good thing if you have checks coming in every day.
It's not a complaint. This is an hallelujah. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Some great stories. Some great people. And then
right.
stories of people dying. It's just quite a group. We've been doing this for 30 years through this beg letter, or 40 years. So it's quite a thing. So I do want to start the show off with a footnote to catch up with last week's blunder on my part about genealogy. So to footnote that the genealogy of Matthew, which I talked about, that started the book, like chapter one, went right into the genealogy and started with Abraham. The one I was looking at for Luke is in chapter 3. It's not during the infant narrative. It's stuck in right after Jesus is baptized. Interesting.
Oh.
And then they put their genealogy it goes all the way backwards to Adam and Eve. Now, genealogies in the first century was a part of literature that validated a divine succession and ownership. So this is something that 1%ers were involved in. Genealogies, the goat herder out there taking care of the master's goats got no genealogy. A goat herder is somebody who belongs to master. It's his household, clan, whatever. And the bigger the goat herder, the bigger the master, the more important the what? Genealogy. So this is how the gospel writers try to validate Jesus by, in Matthew's situation, verifying that he was had genealogy all the way back to Abraham. And in Luke's situation, goes all the way through Abraham and back to Adam and Eve. Because in Luke, it's making a presentation that Jesus is a universal Jewish Messiah. And we all, and that's just wanted to, correct my stupidity last weekend. I couldn't find my glasses, so I couldn't read the fine print. You know, things that to go on. I was also taken up with the whole issue of I was contemplating what to talk about again. Advent themes, and in the Gospel of Luke, the naming of the babies, big deal. You know, who's the name? What's the name of the kid? John. You know that one that struck his father dead, or not dead, but dumb. And right there in the Holy of Holies, and how to name Jesus, what's Jesus' name, lots of issues about naming. Naming is very important. It always has been for people. One of the things I've been thinking about is when people take on names, the name changes them and they change the name. It's a by being who they are. It's when we're a personalist, we work as Catholic workers. Our personalism is defined by other people, other-centered. I find it interesting that the four houses that we have names for, we have four houses here, two of them are women, two of them are men. Hmm. Yeah. Now, the women is Rachel Corey and Chelsea Manning. And Rachel Corey, of course, is the young American woman from the West Coast, Portland, somewhere up there, Seattle, who was in Palestine and stood between the homes of Palestinians in Gaza, I think, and or West Bank, one of the two, and a bulldozer demolished her, killed her. We named our house after Rachel Corey, a young woman who's a peace warrior. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Chelsea Manning.
Yeah.
Who is Chelsea Manning? We all know Chelsea Manning. The military transgender person.
Yeah.
Who represents the conscience of a generation of soldiers.
Indeed. Yes.
As did Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers. And this transgendered person is these two names are the houses we have for half of our houses. The other two is named after Phil Berrigan, and of course that our community is very clearly associated with the Berrigan and the Berrigan way of doing things.
Right.
Dan and Phil have been my rabbis for 40 some years.
Yeah.
And the fourth house is the Dingman House. The Bishop Dingman House, which will forever tie us to our local Catholic Church, and the wonderful leadership of Morris Dingman, who when we started our house after I dropped out of seminary and I had a girlfriend, he embraced us and our community. He visited us. He was the first guy, his chantry allowed me to use their Xerox machine unlimited because I was working as a community organizer for CCI, which is part of one of those human development programs, a good one, that the church donated. And part of that, he let me use his Xerox machine. I mean, carte blanche. I walk into the chancery. I was well known. It's different now. We clearly have evolved. We're now no longer solely Catholic. We're ecumenical. We're an interfaith Catholic worker Catholics in the best sense. We're inclusive. And we're not afraid of others. And we're not dominating that our scene is the only scene. Our community has taken on some of the important positions that the church needs to listen to and assess and embrace, I believe, having to do the Eucharist. Hmm. We begin by saying we should ordain women. Come on, that's silly. We have ordination should be open to all people. Secondly, we should have open communion.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to change any theology.
Exactly.
To have open communion. Yeah. And once you have open communion, all of those silly, stupid questions disappear.
Yeah.
Instead of that, from the pulpit, you speak the truth about the text, and you talk about reconciliation of all sins. And if you're a Catholic priest, you should own that space and be able to speak to it as a Catholic priest. What are they afraid of? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at as I struggle with my church. Thinking about I have to visit and meet a new bishop here after the first of the year. I think that's when we're going to go in and see him. And I don't take this stuff lightly, I guess. And secondly, this is the most disturbing thing for me, for all of the stuff I'm talking about. Personally, the guy's 10 years younger than me. Chuck, I've never had a bishop who's younger than me. And that doesn't say anything about him. It says a lot about me. And I'm just like, this is an amazing surprise for me because I just have never played to a younger guy. I don't know what to say. Is that enough for you?
Well, that'll do, Frank. Yes. Thank you very much. Since this is the last time we'll speak in Advent, because Christmas is almost here.
It sure is.
So let me wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Christmas that is full of Christ rather than the commercial stuff.
Thank you. And celebrate it well. I'm going to do probably another night in jail. I'm going to make it a regular thing. So here we go.
Welcome back, everyone, to the new American Dream Radio Show. I'm so glad that you have joined me tonight. And I've just had some tremendous guests, and I've got one more coming. Coming up, we have M.K. Davis. M.K. Is a Bigfoot researcher, a specialist in films and film restoration. And we're going to call him right about now. And he always has something good to say. So here we go with M.K. Davis. We are trying to call him right now. He joined us from Mississippi. Here we go. Hello, M.K.
Hello.
It's Chuck Gregory, the New
Hey,
American
Chuck.
Dream Radio Show. Welcome. Merry Christmas, almost. Hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's close. Christmas shopping can be dangerous.
That's for sure.
I went out tonight and got something to eat at a restaurant and didn't take my diabetic insulin with me.
Oh, no.
I said, well, I can get back home before, I'll even eat it.
Huh.
And all of a sudden, my wife remembers she forgot something. She needed to go pick it up.
Uh-oh.
And she gets into Walmart. And next thing you know, she's finding other things. Next thing you know, I'm sitting out there, and my blood sugar's started going up. I said, well, I had to call her. I said, look, I got to get back to the house.
Wow.
It's for the good of all.
Yeah, really.
Well, it can be dangerous. So all jokes. A hectic and frantic time. All you folks out there doing your shopping and your traveling, please be careful. I want to talk a little bit tonight about history a little bit. History and science and the institutions that we have come to rely on or we were always taught to rely on in the information age that we live in now, people are becoming less trustful of what those institutions are teaching us about ourselves. And there's been a proliferation of alternative thinking about that, about those the different disciplines. Authors, new books things that that are available now that never were available before have gained a widespread acceptance and toleration. So sometimes you get shocked and surprised at how little they were really letting us in on. And I was reading in a publication called Ancient Origins, and they were talking about the Garden of Eden, and I did not know this, but Eden and what they translated as Eden in the Bible can also be translated as Aden or Aten. Well, Aten was an Egyptian god. He was the almighty god of Egypt under Akhenaten, who worshipped Aten as a monotheistic god. In other words, rather than being part of a pantheon of gods, Aten was a singular god, a monotheistic god, and very much like the god of the Bible. And as it turns out, there were connections between the two. According to this article, Aten was Akhenaten was considered now a heretical pharaoh who decided to abandon all of his plural gods and worship only one god, the Aten, he called it. So he changed his name to Akhenaten, which means Aten of Aten, or Eden. It can also be called Eden. And the writer, the compiler of the first five books of the Bible, was Egyptian, even though he had, a Judean heritage. He was raised as an Egyptian and had access to all the Egyptian schools and knowledge. So he calls the original account of creation, he calls the Garden of Eden, could also be translated as the Garden of Aten, which was amazing to me to hear that, because the Egyptians and the Israelites had, the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. So, this dual knowledge that seems to, permeate the Bible coming out of Egypt is sort of stunning when you see that. Let me read a little bit to you from this article. Let's see here. So what did the term Eden really refer to? Firstly, we should note that the Aramaic I-N-E consonants can be transliterated into English as either an E or an A. And so the name Eden could easily be read as Aden. And if the Garden of Eden was in Egypt, then we may well have a direct Egyptian counterpart of it. If we know that there was a Garden of Aden or Aten located in Middle Egypt, that garden was created by Pharaoh Akhenaten for his god, the Aten. And yet there is a further similarity here, for the name for the Aten can also be spelled as Adam. In addition, the god Aten was spelt with the reed glyph, which is in the Egyptian equivalent of the Hebrew Aini. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but so the god Aten could equally be pronounced as Aten or Eten and even Eden. The similarity here is beginning to look interesting. The hieroglyphs for the god Aten or Aden or Eden, furthermore, if we spell the name of the Egyptian Eten or Eden with an Aleph instead of an Ayin, then we might well derive a word like Aten or Aden, which just happens to be one of the many names for the Israelite God. found in Joshua 3:11, Psalms 12:4, among many other verses. So what it's getting driving at is that many of the accounts of creation, such as found in the Bible, are from an older account. Some of it was from Egypt. Some of it was from Sumer. Maybe the even Akkadians all have very similar accounts, which use similar words, and these words end up in the Bible as a retelling of an older account. And if you look at some of the way that Moses starts out some of these chapters, he says, "This is the account or the history of Adam. This is the history of Noah. This is the history." In other words, he's compiling information that was already written down. Hmm. And so it became real interesting to me that this Pharaoh, who insisted on worshiping a singular monotheistic God, would adopt a name. He wasn't originally named that, but he adopted a name that included Edenic. Achan of Eden is what his name meant, and he considered himself the second Adam, and he portrayed himself as such. And he tried to rebuild or reestablish a garden of Achan, or a garden of Eden, along the Nile, in a place called Armana. In doing so, he angered the priests' pantheon of gods to the point where they wanted to kill him. They plotted to kill him. And when he finally did die, they tried to erase his memory. They got people to go and chisel his name off of the monuments and off the other statues and what have you, to try to pretend that he never happened. What were you saying?
Well, I just had a totally off the wall thought, MK. You know, given the similarity of some of these names, Aten and Eden, Adam. Another name from another mythology crossed my mind. In Norse mythology, the main guy was named Odin, which is awfully similar.
It is. It very, very well is. Yeah. The whole kind of gist of what I'm referring to is that, in like Graham Hancock often says, that there seems to be, if you go far enough back into antiquity, a common belief, a common system, a common that permeates the entire earth, and you find remnants of it in all these different cultures.
Yeah.
As if there was a singular source at one time. In Egypt is a good one to look for. They believe that there, what they feared the most in the beliefs of Egypt was chaos. Huh. They feared chaos. And they believed that order was in the daylight, the sun. But when it got nighttime, you went into chaos. And they had a god they called Set.
Hmm.
And that's actually where we get Satan from. And that Set would be below the horizon. And as the sun set below the horizon, Set would swallow the sun. And that's where we get our term sunset, or setting sun.
Mm.
It's even in English, even modern day, those old terms still still permeate. And so Set ends up as Satan in the scriptures that were written by Moses, the Pentateuch, they call it, the first five books of the Bible. But it has, you have to remember that even Moses' name was Egyptian. They have pharaohs that were named like Tutmosis, you know. So he had all of that knowledge about Set. And so it ends up that he swallows, he's the prince of darkness. He swallows the sun as the sun goes below the horizon. Sunset. It's what we end up calling.
Yeah.
We don't know why we call it that, but we call it that. It's quite a thing. To me, the alternative esoterical knowledge, they call it, is a kind of a bright spot in a long, dark spell where we were subject to either knowing nothing or either knowing what they wanted us to know. So now we get an opportunity to kind of spread our wings a little bit and understand a little more of our world and why things are the way they are. So I guess Graham Hancock said, don't trust anybody with ology behind their name. I guess I've become an oleologist, a person who studies people who have degrees. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the old stuff, you know, from way back in the Egyptian days and how some of it is still so relevant. And how it makes its way across the other religious concepts, and you find the elements of it in almost everything around, even going back into the myths of the past where we were like the Mayans, that were, you know, once they began to understand the Mayan language, they began to realize that it was a similar belief, that was all around the earth at one time. Everybody's not so far apart, really. From through the dawn of time into modern age, you know, if you look for those similarities, we're not that far apart, and things, you know, schisms exist, and people, you know, go their way this way and that way, and break off from one another, but you can still follow it back, you know, into a singular, simplistic religious belief that was the original, you know. So I find that to be utterly fascinating.
Indeed. It really, it just makes you wonder what was that common origin. You know, it's probably morphed in so many different ways in the different religions, but what was it?
Right. It goes farther back than Egypt. You know, I keep referring to Egypt because Egypt has got a lot available out there in the way of hieroglyphs and things like that. But it goes further back even than Egypt. It goes on back to a time when, you know, that there was one simple, singular religion, and the writings of that religion were basically done in hieroglyphs. They were done in the symbols. Egyptian symbols, each symbol means you can translate into English as a letter, or you can translate it as an idea. It translates two ways. They like the symbol of a feather. If you find the feather chiseled into the stone over there in Egypt, it means truth. T-R-U-T-H. a circle with a dot in the middle means Almighty God.
Hmm.
You know, a squiggly line that's horizontal means water.
Hmm.
But if it's at an angle, it means a force. A scarab is a symbol of creation of the earth and the universe.
Right.
And they get that because a scarab beetle rolls a ball of mud, and he makes a big ball of mud, and he rolls it to his den, and he lays eggs in it, and it becomes a little model of the earth. And that's why the scarab beetle was so revered.
Wow.
And it's not just in Egypt, but across the earth. And we call them dung beetles here because you see them, they roll animal dung into
right.
the same thing or into little balls. But they lay their eggs in them, and it represents, to the as far as a religious concept, it represents the creation of the earth
hmm.
and the populating of the earth. You know, by the laying of the eggs.
Hmm.
And laying of eggs has always been a symbol of populating the earth, or the great serpent mound in Ohio, the image of a snake is
hmm.
swallowing an egg.
Hmm.
it's a cosmic egg. It is the beginning. And the snake, it means life. In the Bible, it means something evil, but in most religious concepts, even in the medical symbols, you see a snake
right.
intertwined upon the tree, on the tree of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, there'd be two snakes, you know, but the snake is a symbol of life in most every concept there is. When you see these hieroglyphic symbols, you know, these people weren't just chiseling to have a good time. They were leaving a legacy behind, the story of their beliefs and their consciousness, and as far as what they understood of the universe.
Yeah.
You know, those people were pretty smart. They built some magnificent structures.
Indeed,
that we can't equal, we can't equal today.
Yeah, but I'm just consider how long it took to create, you know, hieroglyphs chiseled in stone, and here we type on a keyboard or we scratch something out, in cursive and. You know, we think we've put so much work into it, but you know, for them it might take years to do what we do in a few minutes or an hour.
Yeah, and some of the stuff that they worked with was so hard. The stone was like diorite.
Yeah.
The hardness of diorite, copper wouldn't touch it.
Huh.
You know, they don't even understand or know how they did it.
Hmm.
Even to this day,
yeah.
And they made like they would do a statue of Ramses.
Hmm.
The right side of his face is a perfect match for the left side.
Hmm.
You know, how do you do that by hand?
Yeah.
You know, it's just
they knew some things.
Stunning.
Yeah,
they sure did, and to this day we don't understand it. We couldn't do that by hand.
Yeah,
there's no artist anywhere that could make a perfect, you know, two halves that are perfect matches of each other.
Right.
And they put a mirror in the middle, and then they pull the mirror back. And what was really there was exactly matching what was in the mirror.
Huh.
You know, when they put it halfway down the nose
yeah,
and the
right.
face.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
It is.
So these people, you know, we don't understand even a fragment of what all went on back then. And
yeah.
And like Graham Hancock says, maybe we shouldn't completely trust the anyone with the ology behind, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a guarantee of correctness.
Of course not.
So I sit and reflect on that, and I think back upon all the pursuits, all the disciplines of science. That we live in the worst of times and the best of times at the same time. that knowledge is filtering out through to the masses in ways that you can't imprison anybody in a bubble anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe what those Egyptians wrote so long ago, maybe that's why they wrote it.
Hmm.
Maybe that's why they bothered to chisel what they knew down.
Wow.
Because it may make it down through the millennia into a time like ours when it becomes meaningful to the masses.
Hmm. Well, I really hope that indeed our time is the time when this can become meaningful to the masses. Sometimes...
We need to know, but
I'd really like to think that that is the case.
Yeah, when it comes to the Earth, you know, I don't know if you've ever read much on the pyramids, but the mathematical conundrums that are engineered into the pyramid are just unbelievable.
Right.
You know, they were talking about the circumference of the Earth. Is built into the pyramids.
Wow.
Astronomical information. Hmm. They're not just haphazardly put together.
Oh, I know.
You know, they're put together with such precision and such insightfulness that who could possibly do that?
Indeed.
You know, we've all been taught that the further back you go into time, the more primitive the mind is. And that's not the case at all.
Huh.
We're kind of dangling on the verge of primitiveness.
Huh.
You know, we're having a hard time understanding the pyramids.
Yes, we are. Well, MK, we have reached the end of our time. I really want to thank you. I always look forward to your segments each month, and I look forward to talking to you again next year. And I want to wish you Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And, hey, this is the New American Dream Radio Show streaming live on Revolution Radio. And we're glad all you listeners showed up. I'm so lucky to have my great guests. See you next week.
Good night, everybody.